This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The Little Book of Common Sense Investing, the only way to guarantee your fair share of stock market returns, 10th Anniversary Edition. Written by John C. Bogle, performed by L.J. Ganser.
Visual aids found in the print edition of this book are available to you as a downloadable PDF. To access this file, please click the link on the product page where you purchased this title. Thank you.
Introduction to the 10th Anniversary Edition. Don't allow a winner's game to become a loser's game. Successful investing is all about common sense. As Warren Buffett, the Oracle of Omaha, has said, it is simple, but it is not easy. Simple arithmetic suggests, and history confirms, that the winning strategy for investing in stocks is to own all of the nation's publicly held businesses at very low cost. By doing so, you are guaranteed to capture almost the entire return that these businesses generate in the form of dividends and earnings growth. The best way to implement this strategy is indeed simple. Buy a fund that holds this all-market portfolio and hold it forever. Such a fund is called an index fund. The index fund is simply a basket, portfolio, that holds many, many eggs, stocks, designed to mimic the overall performance of the U.S. stock market, or any financial market or market sector. Keep in mind that an index may also be constructed around the bond market, or even road-less-traveled asset classes, such as commodities or real estate. Today, if you wish, you could literally hold all your wealth in a diversified portfolio of low-cost, traditional index funds representing every asset class and every market sector within the United States or around the globe. The traditional index fund, TIF, by definition, basically represents the entire stock market basket, not just a few scattered eggs. It eliminates the risk of picking individual stocks, the risk of emphasizing certain market sectors, and the risk of manager selection. Only stock market risk remains. That risk is quite large enough, thank you. Index funds make up for their lack of short-term excitement by their truly exciting long-term productivity. The TIF is designed to be held for a lifetime. The index fund eliminates the risks of individual stocks, market sectors, and manager selection. Only stock market risk remains. This is much more than a book about index funds. It is a book that is determined to change the very way that you think about investing. It is a book about why long-term investing serves you far better than short-term speculation, about the value of diversification, about the powerful role of investment costs, about the perils of relying on a fund's past performance and ignoring the principle of reversion, or regression, to the mean, RTM, in investing, and about how financial markets work. When you understand how our financial markets actually work, you will see that the index fund is indeed the only investment that essentially guarantees that you will capture your fair share of the returns that business earns. Thanks to the miracle of compounding, the accumulations of wealth that are generated by those returns over the years have been little short of fantastic. The Traditional Index Fund, TIF. I'm speaking here about the traditional index fund. The TIF is broadly diversified, holding all, or almost all, of its share of the $26 trillion capitalization of the U.S. stock market in early 2017. It operates with minimal expenses and with no advisory fees, with tiny portfolio turnover, and with high tax efficiency. That traditional index fund, the first one tracked the returns of the Standard & Poor's 500 index, simply owns shares of the dominant firms in corporate America, buying an interest in each stock in the stock market in proportion to its market capitalization, and then holding it forever. The magic of compounding investment returns. The tyranny of compounding investment costs. Please, don't underestimate the power of compounding the generous returns earned by our businesses. Let's assume that the stocks of our corporations earn a return of 7% per year. Compounded at that rate over a decade, each $1 initially invested grows to $2, over two decades to $4, over three decades to $7.50, over four decades to $15, and over five decades to $30. Over the past century, the average nominal return on U.S. stocks was 10.1% per year. In real terms, after 3.4% inflation, the real annual return was 6.7%. During the next decade, both returns are likely to be significantly lower. See Chapter 9. The magic of compounding is little short of a miracle. Simply put, thanks to the growth, productivity, resourcefulness, and innovation of our corporations, capitalism creates wealth, a positive-sum game for its owners. Investing in equities for the long term has been a winner's game. The returns earned by business are ultimately translated into the returns earned by the stock market. I have no way of knowing what share of these market returns you have earned in the past. But academic studies suggest that if you are a typical investor in individual stocks, your returns have probably lagged the market by around 2 percentage points per year. Applying that figure to the annual return of 9.1% earned over the past 25 years by the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index, your annual return has likely been in the range of 7%. Result, investors as a group have been served only about three-quarters of the market pie. In addition, as explained in Chapter 7, if you are a typical investor in mutual funds, you've done even worse. A zero-sum game? If you don't believe that return represents what most investors experience, please think for a moment about The Relentless Rules of Humble Arithmetic, Chapter 4. These iron rules define the game. As investors, all of us as a group earn the stock market's return. As a group, I hope you're sitting down for this astonishing revelation. We investors are average. For each percentage point of extra return above the market that one of us earns, another of our fellow investors suffers a return shortfall of precisely the same dimension. Before the deduction of the costs of investing, beating the stock market is a zero-sum game. A loser's game. As investors seek to outpace their peers, winners' gains inevitably equal losers' losses. With all that feverish trading activity, the only sure winner in the costly competition for outperformance is the person who sits in the middle of our financial system. As Warren Buffett recently wrote, "When trillions of dollars are managed by Wall Streeters charging high fees, it will usually be the managers who reap outsized profits, not the clients." In the casino, the house always wins. In horse racing, the track always wins. In the Powerball lottery, the state always wins. Investing is no different. In the game of investing, the financial croupiers always win, and investors as a group lose. After the deduction of the costs of investing, beating the stock market is a loser's game. Less to Wall Street croupiers means more to Main Street investors. Successful investing, then, is about minimizing the share of the returns earned by our corporations that is consumed by Wall Street, and maximizing the share of returns that is delivered to Main Street. That's you, dear listener. Your chances of earning your fair share of the market's returns are greatly enhanced if you minimize your trading in stocks. One academic study showed that during the strong bull market of 1990 to 1996, the most active one-fifth of all stock traders turned their portfolios over at the rate of more than 21% per month. While they earned the annual market return of 17.9% during that bull market period, they incurred trading costs of about 6.5%, leaving them with an annual return of but 11.4%, only two-thirds of the market return. Mutual fund investors, too, have inflated ideas of their own omniscience. They pick funds based on the recent performance superiority, or even the long-term superiority, of a fund manager, and often hire advisors to help them achieve the same goal. Warren Buffett's helpers, described in the next chapter. But as I explain in Chapter 12, the advisors do it with even less success. Oblivious of the toll taken by costs, too many fund investors willingly pay heavy sales loads and incur excessive fund fees and expenses, and are unknowingly subjected to the substantial but undisclosed transaction costs incurred by funds as a result of their hyperactive portfolio turnover. Fund investors are confident that they can consistently select superior fund managers. They are wrong. Mutual fund investors are confident that they can easily select superior fund managers. They are wrong. Contrarily, for those who invest and then drop out of the game and never pay a single unnecessary cost, the odds in favor of success are awesome. Why? Simply because they own shares of businesses. And businesses as a group earn substantial returns on their capital, pay out dividends to their owners, and reinvest what's left for their future growth. Yes, many individual companies fail. Firms with flawed ideas and rigid strategies and weak managements ultimately fall victim to the creative destruction that is the hallmark of competitive capitalism, only to be succeeded by other firms. Creative destruction is the formulation of Joseph E. Schumpeter in his 1942 book, Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy. But in the aggregate, businesses have grown with the long-term growth of our vibrant economy. Since 1929, for example, our nation's gross domestic product, GDP, has grown at a nominal annual rate of 6.2%. Annual pre-tax profits of our nation's corporations have grown at a rate of 6.3%. The correlation between the growth of GDP and the growth of corporate profits is 0.98%. 1.0 is perfect. I assume that this long-term relationship will prevail in the years ahead. Get out of the casino and stay out. This book intends to show you why you should stop contributing to the croupiers of the financial markets. Why? Because during the past decade, they have raked in something like $565 billion each year from you and your fellow investors. It will also tell you how easy it is to avoid those croupiers. Simply buy a Standard & Poor's 500 index fund or a total stock market index fund. Then, once you have bought your stocks, get out of the casino and stay out. Just hold the market portfolio forever. And that's what the traditional index fund does. Simple, but not easy. This investment philosophy is not only simple and elegant. The arithmetic on which it is based is irrefutable, but it is not easy to follow its discipline. So long as we investors accept the status quo of today's crazy quilt financial market system, so long as we enjoy the excitement, however costly, of buying and selling stocks, and so long as we fail to realize that there is a better way, such a philosophy will seem counterintuitive. But I ask you to carefully consider the impassioned message of this little book. When you do, you too will want to join the index revolution and invest in a new, more economical, more efficient, even more honest way. A more productive way that will put your own interests first. Economical, efficient, and honest are the words I used in my 1951 Princeton University thesis, The Economic Role of the Investment Company. Some principles are eternal. Thomas Paine and Common Sense. It may seem far-fetched for me to hope that any single book could ignite the spark of a revolution in investing. New ideas that fly in the face of the conventional wisdom of the day are always greeted with doubt and scorn, even fear. Indeed, 240 years ago, the same challenge was faced by Thomas Paine, whose 1776 tract, Common Sense, helped spark the American Revolution. Here is what Tom Paine wrote. Perhaps the sentiments contained in the following pages are not yet sufficiently fashionable to procure them general favor. A long habit of not thinking a thing wrong gives it a superficial appearance of being right, and raises at first a formidable outcry in defense of custom. But the tumult soon subsides. Time makes more converts than reason. I offer nothing more than simple facts, plain arguments, and common sense. As we now know, Thomas Paine's powerful and articulate arguments carried the day. The American Revolution led to our Constitution, which to this day defines the responsibilities of our government and our citizens, the very fabric of our society. Similarly, I believe that in the coming era, my own simple facts, plain arguments, and common sense will carry the day for investors. The index revolution will help us build a new and more efficient investment system for our nation, a system in which serving investors is its highest priority. Structure and strategy. Some may suggest that, as the creator both of Vanguard in 1974 and of the world's first index mutual fund in 1975, I have a vested interest in persuading you of my views. Of course I do, but not because it enriches me. It doesn't earn me a penny. Rather, I want to persuade you because those two rocks on which Vanguard was founded all those years ago, our truly mutual fund shareholder-owned structure, and our index fund strategy, will enrich you over the long term. Don't take my word for it. In the early years of indexing, my voice was a lonely one. But there were a few other thoughtful and respected believers whose ideas inspired me to carry on my mission. Today, many of our wisest and most successful investors endorse the index fund concept. Among academics, the acceptance is close to universal. But don't take my word for it. Listen to these independent experts who have no axe to grind except for the truth about investing. You will hear from some of them at the end of each chapter. Listen, for example, to this endorsement by the late Paul A. Samuelson, Nobel laureate in economic sciences and professor of economics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, to whose memory this book is dedicated. Bogle's reasoned precepts can enable a few million of us savers to become, in 20 years, the envy of our suburban neighbors, while at the same time we have slept well in these eventful times. It will take a long time to fix our financial system, but the glacial pace of that change should not prevent you from looking after your own self-interest. You don't need to participate in its expensive foolishness. If you choose to play the winner's game of owning shares of businesses and to refrain from playing the loser's game of trying to beat the market, you can begin the task simply by using your own common sense, understanding the system, and eliminating substantially all of its excessive costs. Then, at last, you will be guaranteed to earn your fair share of whatever returns our businesses may be generous enough to deliver in the years ahead, reflected as they will be in our stock and bond markets. Caution, you'll also earn your fair share of any interim negative returns. When you understand these realities, you'll see that it's all about common sense. The 10th anniversary edition of The Little Book of Common Sense Investing. When the first edition of The Little Book of Common Sense Investing was published 10 years ago, my hope was that investors would find it useful in helping them to earn their fair share of whatever returns, positive or negative, our financial markets deliver. That original Little Book of 2007 was a direct successor to my first book, Bogle on Mutual Funds, New Perspectives for the Intelligent Investor, published in 1994. Both books set forth the case for index investing, and both became the best-selling mutual fund books ever, with investors purchasing a combined total of more than 500,000 copies. During the next quarter century since the publication of my first book, index funds have come into their own. Assets of equity index funds have risen 168-fold, from $28 billion to $4.6 trillion in mid-2017. In the past decade alone, U.S. investors have added $2.1 trillion to their holdings of equity index funds and withdrawn more than $900 billion from their holdings of actively managed equity funds. Such a huge $3 trillion swing in investor preferences surely represents no less than an investment revolution. In retrospect, It seems clear that my pioneering creation of the first index mutual fund in 1975 provided the spark that ignited the index revolution. And it also seems reasonable to conclude that my books, read by an estimated 1.5 million readers, played a major role in fueling the extraordinary power of the revolution that followed. The creative destruction reaped by index funds has, by and large, served investors well. As you listen to this 10th anniversary edition of the Little Book of Common Sense Investing, you'll see that it stands firmly behind the sound principles of its predecessors, with new chapters on dividends, asset allocation, and retirement planning focused on the implementation of those principles. Learn. Enjoy. Act. John C. Bogle, Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, September 1st, 2017. Don't take my word for it. Charles T. Munger, Warren Buffett's business partner at Berkshire Hathaway, puts it this way. The general systems of money management today require people to pretend to do something they can't do and like something they don't. It's a funny business because, on a net basis, the whole investment management business together gives no value added to all buyers combined. That's the way it has to work. Mutual funds charge 2% per year, and then brokers switch people between funds, costing another 3 to 4 percentage points. The poor guy in the general public is getting a terrible product from the professionals. I think it's disgusting. It's much better to be part of a system that delivers value to the people who buy the product. William Bernstein, investment advisor and neurologist, and author of The Four Pillars of Investing, says, "It's bad enough that you have to take market risk. Only a fool takes on the additional risk of doing yet more damage by failing to diversify properly with his or her nest egg. Avoid the problem. Buy a well-run index fund and own the whole market." Here's how The Economist of London puts it. The truth is that, for the most part, fund managers have offered extremely poor value for money. Their records of outperformance are almost always followed by stretches of underperformance. Over long periods of time, hardly any fund managers have beaten the market averages. And all the while, they charge their clients big fees for the privilege of losing their money. One specific lesson is the merits of indexed investing. You will almost never find a fund manager who can repeatedly beat the market. It is better to invest in an indexed fund that promises a market return, but with significantly lower fees. It's really amazing that so many giants of academia, and many of the world's greatest investors known for beating the market, confirm and applaud the virtues of index investing. May their common sense, perhaps even more than my own, make you all wiser investors. Note: Little Book readers interested in reviewing the sources for the Don't Take My Word for It quotes found at the end of each chapter, other quotes in the main text, and the sources of the extensive data that I present can find them on my website, www.johncbogle.com. I wouldn't dream of consuming valuable pages in this small book with a weighty bibliography, so please don't hesitate to visit my website. Chapter 1. A Parable. The Gottrocks Family. Even before you think about index funds, in their most basic form, mutual funds that simply buy shares of substantially all of the stocks in the U.S. stock market and hold them forever, you must understand how the stock market actually works. Perhaps this folksy parable, my version of a story told by Warren Buffett, chairman of Berkshire Hathaway, Inc., in the firm's 2005 annual report, will clarify the foolishness and counterproductivity of our vast and complex financial market system. Once upon a time, a wealthy family named the Gottrocks, grown over the generations to include thousands of brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, and cousins, owned 100% of every stock in the United States. Each year, they reaped the rewards of investing. All of the earnings growth that those thousands of corporations generated, and all of the dividends that they distributed. To complicate matters just a bit, The Gottrocks family also purchased the new public offerings of securities that were issued each year. Each family member grew wealthier at the same pace, and all was harmonious. Their investment compounded over the decades, creating enormous wealth. The Gottrocks family was playing a winner's game. But after a while, a few fast-talking helpers arrive on the scene, and they persuade some smart Gottrocks cousins that they can earn a larger share than their relatives. These helpers convince the cousins to sell their shares in some of the companies to other family members and to buy shares of other companies from them in return. The helpers handle the transactions and, as brokers, they receive commissions for their services. The ownership is thus rearranged among the family members. To their surprise, however, the family wealth begins to grow at a slower pace. Why? Because some of the investment return is now consumed by the helpers, and the family's share of the generous pie that U.S. industry bakes each year, all of those dividends paid, all those earnings reinvested in the businesses, 100% at the outset, starts to decline, simply because some of the return is now consumed by the helpers. To make matters worse, in addition to the taxes the family has always paid on their dividends, some of the members are now also paying capital gains taxes. Their stock swapping back and forth generates capital gains taxes, further diminishing the family's total wealth. The smart cousins quickly realize that their plan has actually diminished the rate of growth in the family's wealth. They recognize that their foray into stock picking has been a failure and conclude that they need professional assistance, the better to pick the right stocks for themselves. So they hire stock picking experts, more helpers, to gain an advantage. These money managers charge fees for their services. So when the family appraises its wealth a year later, it finds that its share of the pie has diminished even further. To make matters still worse, the new managers feel compelled to earn their keep by trading the family's stocks at feverish levels of activity, not only increasing the brokerage commissions paid to the first set of helpers, but running up the tax bill as well. Now the family's earlier 100% share of the dividends and earnings pie is further diminished. Well, we failed to pick good stocks for ourselves, and when that didn't work, we also failed to pick managers who could do so, the smart cousins say. What shall we do? Undeterred by their two previous failures, they decide to hire still more helpers. They retain the best investment consultants and financial planners that they can find to advise them on how to select the right managers, who will then surely pick the right stocks. The consultants, of course, tell them that they can do the job. Just pay us a fee for our services, the new helpers assure the cousins, and all will be well. Alas, with those added costs, the family's share of the pie tumbles once again. Get rid of all your helpers. Then your family will again reap 100% of the pie that corporate America bakes for you. Alarmed at last, the family sits down together and takes stock of the events that have transpired since some of them began to try to outsmart the others. How is it, they ask, that our original 100% share of the pie, made up each year of all those dividends and earnings, has dwindled to just 60%? Their wisest member, a sage old uncle, softly responds, "All that money you've paid to those helpers, and all those unnecessary extra taxes you're paying, come directly out of our family's total earnings and dividends. Go back to square one, and do so immediately. Get rid of all your brokers. Get rid of all your money managers. Get rid of all your consultants. Then our family will again reap 100% of however large a pie corporate America bakes for us, year after year." They followed the old uncle's wise advice, returning to their original passive but productive strategy, holding all the stocks of corporate America and standing pat. That is exactly what an index fund does. And the Gottrocks family lived happily ever after. Adding a fourth law to Sir Isaac Newton's three laws of motion, the inimitable Warren Buffett puts the moral of his story this way. For investors as a whole, returns decrease as motion increases. Accurate as that cryptic statement is, I would add that the parable reflects the profound conflict of interest between those who work in the investment business and those who invest in stocks and bonds. The way to wealth for those in the business is to persuade their clients, don't just stand there, do something. But the way to wealth for their clients in the aggregate is to follow the opposite maxim. Don't do something, just stand there. For that is the only way to avoid playing the loser's game of trying to beat the market. When a business is conducted in a way that directly defies the interests of its clients in the aggregate, it is only a matter of time until the clients awaken to reality. Then the change comes. And that change is driving the revolution in our financial system today. The moral of the Gottrocks story? Successful investing is about owning businesses and reaping the huge rewards provided by the dividends and earnings growth of our nations, and for that matter the world's, corporations. The higher the level of their investment activity, the greater the cost of financial intermediation and taxes, the less the net return that shareholders, as a group, the owners of our businesses, receive. The lower the costs that investors as a group incur, the higher the rewards that they reap. So to enjoy the winning returns generated by businesses over the long term, the intelligent investor will reduce to the bare bones minimum the costs of financial intermediation. That's what common sense tells us. That's what indexing is all about. And that's the central message of this book. Don't take my word for it. Listen to Jack R. Meyer, former president of Harvard Management Company, the remarkably successful wizard who tripled the Harvard University Endowment Fund from $8 billion to $27 billion. Here's what he had to say in a 2004 Business Week interview. The investment business is a giant scam. Most people think they can find managers who can outperform, but most people are wrong. I will say that 85 to 90% of managers fail to match their benchmarks. Because managers have fees and incur transaction costs, you know that in the aggregate they are deleting value. When asked if private investors can draw any lessons from what Harvard does, Mr. Meyer responded, "Yes. First, get diversified. Come up with a portfolio that covers a lot of asset classes. Second, you want to keep your fees low. That means avoiding the most hyped but expensive funds in favor of low-cost index funds. And finally, invest for the long term. Investors should simply have index funds to keep their fees low and their taxes down. No doubt about it." In terms that are a bit less contentious, Princeton University professor Burton G. Malkiel, author of A Random Walk Down Wall Street, expresses these views. Index funds have regularly produced annual rates of return exceeding those of active managers by close to 2 percentage points. Active management as a whole cannot achieve gross returns exceeding the market as a whole, and therefore they must, on average, underperform the indexes by the amount of these expense and transaction costs. Experience conclusively shows that index fund buyers are likely to obtain results exceeding those of the typical fund manager, whose large advisory fees and substantial portfolio turnover tend to reduce investment yields. The index fund is a sensible, serviceable method for obtaining the market's rate of return with absolutely no effort and minimal expense. Chapter 2. Rational Exuberance. Shareholder gains must match business gains. That wonderful parable about the Gottrocks family in Chapter 1 brings home the central reality of investing. The most that owners in aggregate can earn between now and Judgment Day is what their businesses in aggregate earn, in the words of Warren Buffett. Illustrating the point with Berkshire Hathaway, the publicly owned corporation that he has run for 46 years, please heed carefully Mr. Buffett's statement. When the stock temporarily overperforms or underperforms the business, a limited number of shareholders, either sellers or buyers, receive outsized benefits at the expense of those they trade with. Over time, the aggregate gains made by Berkshire shareholders must of necessity match the business gains of the company. Over time, the aggregate gains made by shareholders must of necessity match the business gains of the company. How often investors lose sight of that eternal principle, yet the record is clear. History, if only we would take the trouble to examine it, reveals the remarkable, if essential, linkage between the cumulative long-term returns earned by U.S. business, the annual dividend yield plus the annual rate of earnings growth, and the cumulative returns earned by the stock market. Think about that certainty for a moment. Can you see that it is simple common sense? Need proof? Just look at the record since the beginning of the 20th century. Refer to Exhibit 2.1 in the accompanying PDF. The average annual total return on stocks was 9.5%. The investment return alone was 9.0%, 4.4% from dividend yield and 4.6% from earnings growth. That difference of 0.5 percentage points per year arose from what I call speculative return. Speculative return may be a plus or a minus, depending on the willingness of investors to pay either higher or lower prices for each dollar of earnings at the end of a given period than at the beginning. The price-to-earnings, P/E ratio, measures the number of dollars investors are willing to pay for each dollar of earnings. As investor confidence waxes and wanes, P/E multiples rise and fall. Changes in interest rates also have an impact, uneven though it may be, on the P/E multiple, so I'm oversimplifying a bit here. When greed holds sway, very high P/Es are likely. When hope prevails, P/Es are moderate. When fear is in the saddle, P/Es are typically very low. Back and forth, over and over again, swings in the emotions of investors are reflected in speculative return. They momentarily derail the steady long-range upward trend in the economics of investing. As reflected in Exhibit 2.1, the investment return on stocks, dividend yield plus earnings growth, tracks closely with the total market return, including the impact of speculative return over the long term. Any significant divergences between the two are short-lived. Compounding these returns over 116 years produces accumulations that are truly staggering. Each dollar initially invested in stocks in 1900, at a return of 9.5%, grew by the close of 2015 to $43,650. But let's be fair. If we compound that initial $1, not at the nominal return of 9.5%, but at the real rate of 6.3%, after 3.2% inflation during the period, $1 grows to $1,339, but a fraction of the accumulation in nominal terms. But increasing real wealth more than 1,300 times over is not to be sneezed at. Sure, few, if any of us, have 116 years in us, but our descendants follow us, and, like the Gottrocks family, enjoy the miracle of compounding returns. These returns have been little short of amazing, the ultimate winner's game. As Exhibit 2.1 makes clear, there are bumps along the way in the investment returns earned by our business corporations. Sometimes, as in the Great Depression of the early 1930s, these bumps were large, but we got over them. So if you stand back from the chart and squint your eyes, the trend of business fundamentals looks almost like a straight line sloping gently upward, and those periodic bumps are barely visible. Reversion to the mean. To be sure, stock market returns sometimes get well ahead of business fundamentals, as in the late 1920s, the early 1970s, and the late 1990s, perhaps even today. But it has been only a matter of time until, as if drawn by a magnet, they ultimately return to the long-term norm, although often only after falling well behind for a time, as in the mid-1940s, the late 1970s, and the 2003 market lows. It's called reversion, or regression, to the mean, RTM, which we'll discuss in depth in Chapter 11. In our foolish focus on the short-term stock market distractions of the moment, we investors often overlook this long history. When the returns on stocks depart materially from the long-term norm, we ignore the reality that it is rarely because of the economics of investing, the earnings growth and dividend yields of our corporations. Rather, the reason that annual stock returns are so volatile is largely because of the emotions of investing, reflected in those changing P/E ratios. It is dangerous to apply to the future inductive arguments based on past experience. What Exhibit 2.1 shows is that while the prices we pay for stocks often lose touch with the reality of corporate values, in the long run, reality rules. So, while investors seem to intuitively accept that the past is inevitably prologue to the future, any past stock market returns that have included a high speculative stock return component are deeply flawed guides to what lies ahead. To understand why past returns do not foretell the future, we need only heed the words of the great British economist John Maynard Keynes. Here's what he wrote 81 years ago. It is dangerous to apply to the future inductive arguments based on past experience unless one can distinguish the broad reasons why past experience was what it was. But if we can distinguish the reasons the past was what it was, then we can establish reasonable expectations about the future. Keynes helped us make this distinction by pointing out that the state of long-term expectation for stocks is a combination of enterprise, forecasting the prospective yield of assets over their whole life, and speculation, forecasting the psychology of the market. I'm well familiar with those words, for 66 years ago, I incorporated them into my senior thesis at Princeton University. It was entitled The Economic Role of the Investment Company. It led, providentially, to my lifetime career in the mutual fund industry. The dual nature of stock market returns. This dual nature of returns is clearly reflected when we look at stock market returns over the decades. Refer to Exhibit 2.2 in the accompanying PDF. Putting my own numbers to Keynes's idea, I divide stock market returns into two parts. One, investment return, enterprise, consisting of the initial dividend yield on stocks plus their subsequent earnings growth. Together, they form the essence of what we call intrinsic value. And two, speculative return, the impact of changing price-to-earnings multiples on stock prices. Let's begin with investment returns. The top section of Exhibit 2.2 shows the average annual investment return on stocks over each of the decades since 1900. Note first the steady contribution of dividend yields to total return during each decade. Always positive, only twice outside the range of 3% to 7%, and averaging 4%. Then note that the contribution of earnings growth to investment return, with the exception of the depression-ridden 1930s, was positive in every decade and above 9% in several decades, but usually ran between 4% and 7%, and averaged 4.6% per year. Result: total investment returns, the top section combining dividend yield and earnings growth, were negative in only a single decade, again in the 1930s. While these decade-long total investment returns, the gains made by business, varied, I consider them remarkably steady. They generally ran in the range of 8% to 13% annually and averaged 9%. Enter speculative return. Enter speculative return, shown in the middle section of Exhibit 2.2. Compared with the relative consistency of dividends and earnings growth over the decades, truly wild variations in speculative return punctuate the chart. PEs wax and wane, often with a remarkable impact on returns. For example, a 100% rise in the PE from 10 to 20 times over a decade would equate to a 7.2% annual speculative return. As you can see, without exception, every decade of significantly negative speculative return was immediately followed by a decade in which it turned positive by a correlative amount, the negative 1910s and then the roaring 1920s, the dispiriting 1940s, and then the booming 1950s, the discouraging 1970s, and then the soaring 1980s. This pattern is reversion to the mean writ large. RTM can be thought of as the tendency for those PEs to return to their long-term norms over time. Periods of subpar performance tend to be followed by periods of recovery, and vice versa. Then, amazingly, during the 1990s, there was an unprecedented second consecutive exuberant increase, a pattern never before in evidence. A return to sanity. In April 1999, the P.E. ratio had risen to an unprecedented level of 34 times, setting the stage for the return to sanity in valuations that soon followed. The tumble in stock market prices gave us our comeuppance. With earnings continuing to rise, the P.E. currently stands at 23.7 times, compared with the 15 times level that prevailed at the start of the 20th century. As a result, speculative return has added just 0.5 percentage points to the annual investment return earned by our businesses over the long term. Our measure of the P.E. ratio at the close of 2016 is based on the year-end price of $22.47 for the S&P 500 relative to reported earnings for 2016 of $95 per share, a P.E. of 23.7. Wall Street analysts tend to rely on operating earnings, before write-offs and other negatives, that are forecast for the coming year, $118 per share. Resulting P.E., 17.4 times. Combining investment return and speculative return, total stock market returns. When we combine these two sources of stock returns, we get the total return produced by the stock market, the lower section of Exhibit 2.2. Despite the huge impact of speculative return, up and down, during most of the individual decades, there is virtually no impact over the long term. The average annual total return on stocks of 9.5%, then, has been created almost entirely by enterprise, with only 0.5 percentage point created by speculation. The message is clear. In the long run, stock returns depend almost entirely on the reality of the investment returns earned by our corporations. The perception of investors, reflected by the speculative returns, counts for little. It is economics that controls long-term equity returns. The impact of emotions, so dominant in the short term, dissolves. Accurately forecasting short-term swings in investor emotions is not possible. But forecasting the long-term economics of investing has carried remarkably high odds of success. Even after more than 66 years in this business, I have almost no idea how to forecast these short-term swings in investor emotions. I'm not alone. I don't know anyone who has done so consistently, nor even anyone who knows anyone who has done so. In fact, 70 years of financial research finds no one who has done so. But, largely because the arithmetic of investing is so basic, I have been able to forecast the long-term economics of investing with remarkably high odds of success. Why? Simply because it is investment returns, the earnings and dividends generated by American businesses, that are almost entirely responsible for the returns delivered in our stock market over the long term. While illusion, the momentary prices we pay for stocks, often loses touch with reality, the intrinsic values of our corporations, it is reality that rules in the long run. The real market and the expectations market. To drive this point home, think of investing as consisting of two different games. Here's how Roger Martin, Dean of the Rotman School of Management of the University of Toronto, describes them. One game is the real market, where giant publicly held companies compete, where real companies spend real money to make and sell real products and services, and, if they play with skill, earn real profits and pay real dividends. This game also requires real strategy, determination, and expertise, real innovation, and real foresight. Loosely linked to this game is another game, the expectations market. Here, prices are not set by real things like sales margins or profits. In the short term, stock prices go up only when the expectations of investors rise, not necessarily when sales, margins, or profits rise. The stock market is a giant distraction to the business of investing. To this crucial distinction, I would add that the expectations market is largely a product of the expectations of speculators, trying to guess what other investors will expect and how they will act as each new bit of information finds its way into the marketplace. The expectations market is about speculation. The real market is about investing. The stock market, then, is a giant distraction to the business of investing. Too often, the market causes investors to focus on transitory and volatile short-term expectations rather than on what is really important, the gradual accumulation of the returns earned by corporate businesses. When Shakespeare wrote that it is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing, he could have been describing the inexplicable daily, month-by-month, or even annual swings in stock prices. My advice to investors: ignore the short-term sound and fury of the emotions reflected in our financial markets, and focus on the productive, long-term economics of our corporate businesses. The way to investment success is to get out of the expectations market of stock prices and cast your lot with the real market of business. Don't take my word for it. Simply heed the timeless distinction made by Benjamin Graham, legendary investor, author of The Intelligent Investor, and mentor to Warren Buffett. He was right on the money when he put his finger on the essential reality of investing. In the short run, the stock market is a voting machine. In the long run, it is a weighing machine. Using his wonderful metaphor of Mr. Market, Ben Graham says, imagine that in some private business you own a small share which cost you $1,000. One of your partners, named Mr. Market, is very obliging indeed. Every day he tells you what he thinks your interest is worth and, furthermore, offers either to buy you out or to sell you an additional interest on that basis. Sometimes his idea of value appears plausible and justified by business developments and prospects as you know them. Often, on the other hand, Mr. Market lets his enthusiasm or his fears run away with him, and the value he proposes seems little short of silly. If you are a prudent investor, will you let Mr. Market's daily communication determine your view as the value of your $1,000 interest in the enterprise? Only in case you agree with him, or in case you want to trade with him. But the rest of the time, you will be wiser to form your own ideas of the value of your holdings. The true investor will do better if he forgets about the stock market and pays attention to his dividend returns and to the operating results of his companies. The investor with a portfolio of sound stocks should expect their prices to fluctuate and should neither be concerned by sizable declines nor become excited by sizable advances. He should always remember that market quotations are there for his convenience, either to be taken advantage of or to be ignored. Chapter 3. Cast Your Lot with Business. Win by keeping it simple. Rely on Occam's Razor. How do you cast your lot with business? Simply by buying a portfolio that owns shares of every business in the United States and then holding it forever. This simple concept guarantees you will win the investment game played by most other investors who, as a group, are guaranteed to lose. Please, don't equate simplicity with stupidity. Way back in 1320, William of Ockham nicely expressed the virtue of simplicity, essentially setting forth this precept. When there are multiple solutions to a problem, choose the simplest one. William of Ockham expressed it more elegantly. Entities should not be multiplied unnecessarily, but the point is unmistakable. And so, Occam's razor came to represent a major principle of scientific inquiry. By far the simplest way to own all of U.S. businesses is to hold the total stock market portfolio, or its equivalent. Occam's razor. When there are multiple solutions to a problem, choose the simplest one. For the past 90 years, the accepted stock market portfolio has been represented by the Standard & Poor's 500 Index, the S&P 500. It was created in 1926 as the composite index and now lists 500 stocks. Until 1957, the S&P index included just 90 companies. It is essentially composed of the 500 largest U.S. corporations, weighted by the value of their market capitalizations. In recent years, these 500 stocks have represented about 85% of the market value of all U.S. stocks. The beauty of such a market cap-weighted index is that it never needs to be rebalanced by buying and selling shares due to changing stock prices. With the enormous growth of corporate pension funds between 1950 and 1990, the S&P 500 was an ideal measurement standard, the benchmark, or hurdle rate, that would be the comparative standard for how the professional managers of pension funds were performing. Today, the S&P 500 remains a valid standard against which to compare the returns earned by the professional managers of pension funds and mutual funds. The Total Stock Market Index. In 1970, an even more comprehensive measure of the U.S. stock market was developed. Originally called the Wilshire 5000, it is now named the Dow Jones-Wilshire Total Stock Market Index. It now includes some 3,599 stocks, including the 500 stocks in the S&P 500. Because its component stocks also are weighted by their market capitalization, those remaining 3,099 stocks with smaller capitalizations account for only about 15% of its value. Full disclosure, Vanguard created the first index mutual fund, tracking the Standard & Poor's 500 index in 1975. The firm also created the first total stock market index fund in 1992. This broadest of all U.S. stock indexes is the best measure of the aggregate value of stocks, and therefore a superb measure of the returns earned in U.S. stocks by all investors as a group. As just indicated, both indexes hold the very same large stocks. Exhibit 3.1 in the accompanying PDF shows the 10 largest stocks in each and their weights in the construction of each index. Given the similarity of these two portfolios, it is hardly surprising that the two indexes have earned returns that are in lockstep with one another. The Center for Research in Security Prices at the University of Chicago has gone back to 1926 and calculated the returns earned by all U.S. stocks. The returns of the S&P 500 Index and the Dow Jones Wilshire Total Stock Market Index parallel one another with near precision. From 1926, the beginning of the measurement period, through 2016, you can hardly tell them apart. Refer to Exhibit 3.2 in the accompanying PDF. For the full period, the average annual return on the S&P 500 was 10.0%. The return on the total stock market index was 9.8%. This comparison is what we call period dependent. Everything depends on the starting date and the ending date. If we were to begin the comparison at the beginning of 1930 instead of 1926, the returns of the two would be identical, 9.6% per year. Yes, there are variations over the interim periods. The S&P 500 was much the stronger from 1982 to 1990, when its annual return of 15.6% outpaced the total stock market index return of 14.0%. But since then, small and mid-cap stocks have done a bit better, and the total stock market index return of 10.2% per year narrowly exceeded the 9.9% return of the S&P 500. But with a long-term correlation of 0.99 between the returns of the two indexes, 1.00 is perfect correlation, there is little to choose between the two. You should know that, in establishing a trust for his wife's estate, Warren Buffett directed that 90% of its assets be invested in a low-cost S&P 500 index fund. Returns earned in the stock market must equal the gross returns earned by all investors in the market. Whichever measure we use, it should now be obvious that the returns earned by the publicly held corporations that compose the stock market must of necessity equal the aggregate gross